Good day. Today is Saturday, 11th October 2025. And before coming to the substance, the substantive matters of this video, let me just briefly remind you again to tick the like button if having heard the video or that part of the video that you want to listen to, you liked the video. Please remember, as I said, to tick the like button. Now, before getting into the more substantive topics in this programme, which will again cover the conflict in Ukraine, there are a number of issues that have arisen that I want to talk about, because the last 24 hours have been packed with news about many matters. Let me, first of all, start with the most unimportant one, if you like, the more ridiculous one, in my opinion, which is the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, there's been a great deal said about the Nobel Peace Prize, and somewhat to my surprise, this has continued over the last couple of days, the last couple of hours, since the decision was made by the Nobel Peace Prize Committee to award the Nobel Peace Prize to Maria Corina Machado, the Venezuelan opposition politician, rather than Donald Trump. And amongst the people who weighed in on the subject is President Putin of Russia. He's made it fairly clear that he doesn't think much of the Nobel Peace Prize. He says it's been tarnished. He says correctly that people, and it's clear that he means former President Barack Obama, have been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for doing nothing at all. He said that he was not going to discuss whether Donald Trump deserved to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. This was not a matter for him, but he did say that at least Donald Trump has made attempts to broker peace agreements in various conflicts around the world. And again, he was obviously making a contrast with Barack Obama, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize at the very outset of his presidency, even though there were no actual substantive grounds to do so. Donald Trump liked Putin's comments and published a comment of his own on Truth Social, basically thanking Putin for having made them. Well, I agree with Putin, and I'm going to say that his comments also, as far as I can see, apply equally to Maria Corina Machado. I have, since the announcement of her winning of the prize, I've had a look at her biography, and I'm completely unable to see anything that, as far as I can see, merits awarding her a Peace Prize. The Peace Prize Committee said that they're awarding her the prize because she is working hard to achieve a peaceful transition of power from the current Venezuelan dictator, who presumably is President Maduro. Well, that in itself seems to me debatable. But from what I can see, Maria Corina Machado, at least back in the 90s, appears to have supported the coup attempt, the military coup attempt, against the former Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. In fact, apparently, I mean, I may be wrong here, but as I understand it, she was openly and enthusiastically supportive of that particular coup attempt. And, well, that doesn't suggest to me, if this is true, that she's somebody who's particularly interested in peaceful transitions. And at the present moment in time, from what I can see, well, one can argue about whether she currently supports a peaceful transition from President Maduro, but we have American fleets and ships mobilizing around Venezuela. And suffice to say that, as far as I can tell, she has not been outspokenly critical of those deployments and said, as you would expect, of a Peace Prize laureate, that military action by all of these fleets and warships and all of the rest to prevent a transition in Venezuela is something that needs to be done. Again, it may be that I am overlooking comments of that kind, but for the record, I haven't myself seen them. So I am not sure what she has done that merits awarding her a Peace Prize. That's the first thing. The second thing I want to say is that I personally, and here I accept I am unusual, I think that if you're going to have a Peace Prize at all, then people who actually lead countries or aspire to lead countries, presidents and prime ministers and heads of state and foreign ministers and people of that kind, should not be awarded Peace Prizes at all. I say that because, in my opinion, the duty of a statesman, the duty of somebody who leads a country, is to seek to achieve and maintain peace. Sometimes that isn't possible, but that is what all world leaders should at all times work towards. It is, as far as I am concerned, the most important single duty of a statesman, of a political leader. And given that it is their duty, I don't think they should be rewarded for achieving it, even if they do achieve it, because I don't think one should be paid, basically, for already doing what is one's highly paid job. Anyway, that is my view. Others might take issue with it, but personally, I think the Nobel Peace Prize went wrong long, long ago, long before Obama was awarded it, far beyond the times that Putin and Trump are currently talking about. Now let's talk about more serious matters. The biggest event that took place yesterday is an extraordinary exchange between the United States and China on the eve of what looked like it would be a summit meeting between the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and the President of China, Xi Jinping. And it should be said that it was China that initiated the exchange. China, over the course of the previous 36 hours, 36 to 48 hours, started to impose a whole range of restrictions on exports of rare earths. It required a detailed licensing system. It imposed a detailed licensing system for buyers from China of rare earths and of buyers from China for equipment to refine rare earths. And I understand that these restrictions went beyond the simple question of rare earths and have covered other exports, strategic exports by China, which I'm not going to discuss or detail in this program. Anyway, completely unsurprisingly, this provoked a furious response from President Trump. There was an angry post on Truth Social. And in the next few hours, President Trump announced that if these restrictions from China remained in effect, he would in turn impose 100% tariffs on Chinese goods over and above the existing tariffs, which currently apply against Chinese goods, catapulting China and the United States back into the trade war crisis that we saw in the spring and the early summer. And he initially seemed to imply that he was cancelling the summit meeting between himself and President Xi Jinping, but then he walked that back And he said that he hadn't exactly cancelled that meeting, but that that meeting might not nonetheless take place, and he was not sure whether it would take place. Well, what explains all of these moves and counter moves? As I said, this time it's clear that it was China that initiated the exchange. Now, having said that, it's important to keep a number of things in mind, which is that the Chinese have taken action against the United States, unusual action, action that appears to have taken President Trump completely by surprise, and for that reason appears to have infuriated him. But what the Chinese are doing is actually very little different, as far as I can see, from what the Western powers routinely do. Every single day, every week of every year, most months over the course of a year, the United States and its European allies impose tariffs or sanctions on someone. They do this continuously. They do this against Russia. They're increasingly doing it against China as well. They are doing it against all kinds of other countries around the world. They impose sanctions and restrictions and tariffs against individuals and corporate entities in various countries. They seize ships on the high seas, as France, Emmanuel Macron, recently and briefly did, and noticed that this was a ship which was apparently carrying Russian oil to China. They do all of these things all of the time. And they act as if they have a right to do it. Their sense of entitlement on this issue is absolutely staggering. They consider that they have a perfect right to disregard trade rules, the rules of the World Trade Organization. By the way, and for the record, the concept of a rules-based international order originally flowed out of the various rules on commercial trade that had been agreed in the various free trade rounds, which come under the umbrella of the World Trade Organization. The United States, however, has repeatedly gone against those so-called rules. The mechanisms to enforce the rules via the World Trade Organization have essentially broken down. I understand that there's no appointment anymore. There's a basic block on the various arbitration panels. Anyway, I'm not going to get into all of those details. But anyway, the point is that the Western powers have consistently taken the line that they're entitled to impose sanctions and tariffs and sanctions against countries, businesses, individuals, and they do this round the clock all the time. When the same thing is done against them, they are furious. They regard this as somehow something absolutely outrageous. I remember a couple of years ago when China, for the first time, imposed sanctions against certain individuals in Britain, for example. Those individuals were absolutely furious about it. They'd written all kinds of critical articles about China. They'd complained about some of the things that China does or is alleged to do in territories in Western China and in Hong Kong. They brought all of that up. And then when China responded by imposing sanctions against them, they were outraged. And as far as I could see, genuinely outraged. Well, here we have had examples, a further example of China hitting back, doing to the West that which the West every single day, literally every single day, does to more and more others. And we see that the President of the United States, who's been busy orchestrating the capture of Chinese social media platforms, who has whose administration once played a part in the arrest of a, well, not this administration, but the previous administration, played a significant part in the arrest of the senior executive of a major Chinese communications company, which then impose all kinds of restrictions on that particular company, basically driving it out of Western markets. The same president whose administration, and by the way, here he's been no different from the previous administration, have imposed all kinds of restrictions on high technology exports to China. Anyway, he's now outraged that the Chinese are responding in kind and doing the same thing. Now, having said that, there is still a question as to why exactly the Chinese did it at this particular moment. Now, I don't know, but I suspect that there's been a great deal going on under the surface, some of which I suspect has not been reported. What I have noticed is that over the last couple of weeks, the Chinese position relative to the United States and to the Western powers has been steadily hardening. They have, for example, refused to go even through the motions of abiding by Western sanctions against Russia. So they've signed off on the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline project. They are now resuming cooperation on aerospace matters with Russia, and they're apparently in the process of negotiating with the Russians on the principle of buying high bypass turbofan engines, an engine that China was developing itself with cooperation from France for its new wide-body jet, has apparently fallen below expectations. And I suspect anyway that the Chinese are becoming increasingly nervous of further cooperation with France. Whereas the Russians, over the last few weeks, have confirmed that their big aircraft engine, the PD-35, is now entering the second phase of its bench tests. In other words, that it is almost at the end of its development program and that it is approaching serial production. And there is a new engine, the PD-26, a lower-rated engine, which apparently is going to be developed on the basis of the PD-35 technologies. So the Russians are in a position to offer the Chinese what look like effective and successful engines that the Chinese might be interested in acquiring and perhaps co-developing and using as a base for developing their own aircraft engine industry. That happens, by the way, a great deal. And anyway, they look like they're resuming, therefore, cooperation with the Russians on aerospace matters. They've agreed visa-free rules for Russian visitors to China. The Russians, by the way, have now reciprocated, and they've agreed visa-free rules for Chinese visitors to Russia. They've opened the Chinese financial markets to flotations by Russian companies, flotations of bonds, and who knows, maybe in time, flotations of subsidiaries of Russian companies on the Shanghai stock markets. It's not impossible. They seem to be moving forward with the Russians on developments of digital platforms, on development of databases, on even co-production of AI chips. This is what I've heard. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that. That's an interesting story. about which there is an awful lot more to say. Anyway, a lot is going on there. The Chinese are no longer enforcing. They're no longer even going through the pretense of enforcing sanctions, Western sanctions, against the Russians. And they've also made clear that they will continue to buy Russian crude oil, and that they're going to, in fact, apparently increase their buying of Russian crude oil. And the Chinese have been taking other steps as well. There's now apparently an agreement between India and China that India can buy Russian oil, paying for Russian oil with Chinese currency, with Chinese RMB. Until very recently, India was very unwilling to do that, and the Chinese were very unwilling to let India do that. And India paid for Russian oil in Indian rupees, and this was creating problems because there was a pile-up of rupees in Russian accounts, which they weren't quite clear how to use in India itself. But now more flexibility is being introduced to this market. And both Chinese and Russian cards and payment systems are starting to integrate more with each other, and there is an awful lot more going on there. So we could see that China has all gradually been hardening its positions in all sorts of ways. I've just pointed to some of them. And it seems to me that these restrictions on rare earth exports, which, by the way, fall short of an outright ban on exports of rare earths, are a further indicator on this. There must also be a growing sense in China that why should China continue to provide things like rare earths, which are used by the United States to develop military technologies, including, by the way, AI technologies, but even things like fighter jets and things like that, F-35 fighter jets, which ultimately the United States is going to use against China. There is a narrative, a very powerful narrative, that you find all of the time in the United States, that in 2027, some kind of great confrontation, military confrontation, between China and the United States might happen. There's been suggestions that China might be planning some kind of an attack on Taiwan by 2027. I ought to stress, I read the Chinese media extensively. I've seen no hint of any of this from any Chinese media outlet or any comment that I can find of any Chinese official. But anyway, there has been a lot of talk about this in the West and about how the United States and the Western powers need to be prepared for this armed clash between China and the United States. And, well, it seems to me as if the Chinese are now starting to say, enough's enough. The time for us has come to treat the Americans in the same way that the Americans treat us, as an adversary, if not perhaps yet quite an enemy, and to start taking precautions not to provide technology to the United States or raw materials to the United States, which the United States might have difficulty otherwise accessing, and which might be used against China and Chinese interests, and for China to press forward, strengthening its alliances within BRICS with countries like Russia. Now, the Chinese, who I suspect have some understanding by now of President Trump and his officials, must have calculated that the United States perhaps might respond fiercely to these restrictions, and that the return to the trade war that we saw in the late spring and early summer was a quite possible American response to the latest move that the Chinese are taking. And I can't help but feel that here again, the Chinese are saying to themselves, or at least they're saying to the Americans, bring it on. Bring it on. We saw you off in the spring and summer. You've talked about 100% tariffs against us because we buy Russian oil. You're imposing all this restrictions on us and all of this harassment on us. You want a meeting with our president. Well, if you want all of these things, if you're going to continue to behave in this way, well, we're ready. We're prepared to take you on. We are confident that we will win. Bring it on. Anyway, let's see how this develops. I'm going to make a guess that right across the American industrial system, manufacturing system, especially the AI people, and bear in mind, there's been a lot of talk and discussion in all sorts of places about an AI bubble in the US stock market. For the record, the person who has discussed this, as far as I'm concerned, best is Eve Smith, the indispensable Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism. And it's been interesting to see, by the way, how journals like the Financial Times and others are now several weeks later after Eve Smith began to raise the alarm bells, ring the alarm bells about the stock market bubble, the AI stock market bubble, how the Financial Times and other media outlets are now following on from her in her wake. Anyway, I suspect that all of these people are going to be very alarmed and very frightened by what is happening. I think they understand that without rare earths and other items that China provides, it's going to be much more difficult to sustain the momentum. And in fact, we've already seen, following the tariff announcement, a crash in, well, not a crash, but anyway, a fall in the US stock market. So I suspect that over the next few weeks, up to the moment when the new tariffs are due to come into effect on the 1st of November, there will be desperate attempts by officials in the United States to patch up something with the Chinese to ensure that the supplies of rare earths continue relatively unimpeded, and that the tariffs that President Trump is threatening and the counter tariffs that the Chinese are certain to impose will not come into effect. And well, we have already seen that the President of the United States has now walked back on earlier signals that he seemed to be preparing to cancel his meeting with Xi Jinping. Anyway, let's keep an eye on all of this. It's obviously a major drama, and it has come for the West, for the United States, for the president, as a shock, as a clear bolt out of the blue sky. The last point that I want to discuss is that we still seem to be moving forward, at least at the moment, with the Gaza ceasefire plan. Now, apparently, the United States has agreed to take a coordinating role in the peacekeeping force that is going to be sent to Gaza. And they're setting up a headquarters in Israel, staffed by 200 US military officials. But the makeup of the peacekeeping force itself does appear to be drawn overwhelmingly from Arab and Muslim countries. And I noticed that Egypt and some of the Gulf states are involved, and I still expect Indonesia to be involved as well. And interestingly, Turkey is apparently going to be sending some of its troops. And of course, Turkey has a long-standing connection to Hamas. Just to say, President Erdogan has been one of Hamas's more public supporters. I would be careful if I was Hamas before making any assumptions about Turkey, by the way. But anyway, a peacekeeping force of some kind is starting to crystallize. And it looks increasingly, well, I understand that the Arab states and Turkey, and I suspect Hamas as well, are insisting that this peacekeeping force be provided by a proper with a proper mandate from the UN Security Council. And I firmly expect a meeting of the Security Council, the UN Security Council, to provide such a mandate is going to come fairly soon. Now, if this happens, and if Arab and Turkish troops and troops from other Muslim states really do enter Gaza as a UN mandated peacekeeping force, then this is a very important event. It is the first time that Arab armies will have deployed to the territory of the British Mandate of Palestine since the 1967 Six-Day War. And I can't help but think that if that does indeed happen, then it is only a question of time before demands start to grow for a similar peacekeeping force to be deployed in the West Bank. That is still a long way off, but that does seem to me at least a possibility to bear in mind. Now, I'm not going to say more about what is happening. I still believe that there will be powerful forces within Israel itself that will want to push back hard against this plan and the way it is playing out. And of course, Hamas and some of the other Palestinian groups in Gaza will have their own concerns, which might also play a role in derailing this whole process. But to repeat again, we do seem to be moving forward towards deployment of some kind of peacekeeping force. And if that does happen, in terms of Middle East diplomacy, that is indeed a game changer. Now, lastly, on questions of the Middle East, over the course of the trip to Dushanbe, President Putin of Russia said that he had had discussions with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, and that over the course of those discussions, Prime Minister Netanyahu gave Putin some kind of assurance, which Putin then passed on to the Iranians. And from what we can see, from what the hints imply, it seems as if these assurances were to the effect that Israel was not looking, despite all of the other indications, for a renewal of the conflict with Iran, but would prefer some kind of peaceful solution to the conflict. Now, all this is difficult to understand, and it's very contrary to some of the signals that I've been discussing in various programs recently, which, on the contrary, did appear to suggest military deployments by the United States and Israel as well. But it is indeed the case that on October 6th, Putin and Netanyahu did indeed have a conversation. And I'll just read the Russian readout, which is interesting. The two leaders had a thorough discussion of the latest developments in the Middle East, in particular in light of the plan to normalize the situation in Gaza, put forward by the President of the United States. Vladimir Putin reiterated Russia's steadfast support for resolving the issue of Palestine comprehensively using the well-known basis of international law. The Russians have supported this peace plan, and whilst I doubt that they are major players, they have probably assisted to some extent behind the scenes with some of the parties. The Russians have long-standing contacts with Hamas, for example, and it may be that they have given advice, strong advice, to Hamas to accept the Trump plan. And, of course, they've probably been signalling the same thing to the Iranians, who have also, by the way, basically supported the peace plan. Anyway, then the readout goes on to say this. There was, in addition, there was an exchange of views on several other regional matters. Notably, interest was expressed in searching for ways to settle the situation surrounding Iran's nuclear program and to stabilize the situation in Syria further via negotiations. And then the two, Putin and Netanyahu, exchanged congratulations. Netanyahu congratulated Putin on his 73rd birthday, and Putin congratulated Netanyahu and the people of Israel for the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. So they did discuss, and the Russians confirmed it in this readout, Putin and Netanyahu did discuss the question of Iran's nuclear enrichment program. And the Israelis do seem to have signalled that they were looking for more peaceful compromises after all, despite all of the signals about continued belligerence that we have seen over the last few weeks. Now, the consensus is, and it's not a consensus I'm going to push back against, that the reason for all of this sudden outbreak of more peaceful language from Israel is that the Americans, in particular, were profoundly infuriated and shocked by the military strike, Israel's military strike, on the attempted assassination of the Hamas delegates in Qatar, that they were taken aback by the strong reaction to that strike by the Gulf Arab states. The Americans, the president himself, President Trump, realized that this was a turning point, that this could be a turning point in relations between the Gulf Arab states and the Americans, and that for that reason, Trump basically forced Netanyahu to apologize to the Emir of Qatar for the strike. And the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has also, as a result, basically forced Netanyahu to accept this plan, which we're all told is Trump's plan, but which, as I've discussed previously, has its origins in ideas proposed by the Arab states, and that this is the reason why we have seen this breakthrough over the last couple of weeks. The breakthrough in terms of the diplomacy with Gaza and the breakthrough or the apparent easing of tensions with Iran. Now, as I have no other explanation, I'm going to run with that for the moment. I have to say that I don't believe that a leopard changes its spots. I don't believe that this Prime Minister Netanyahu has really changed his objectives. And I certainly don't believe that the rest of the Israeli cabinet has done so either. So I remain deeply sceptical about this whole process and its prospects. But scepticism is one thing. Hope is something else. I hope that my scepticism will prove wrong and that all of these latest signals about an easing of tensions in the Middle East and about the establishment of a ceasefire in Gaza, I hope that all of these signals crystallize and gain concrete form, and that we are indeed at a turning point in the situation, the recent situation in the Middle East. As I said, I still have my doubts, but let's hope and see. Now, with all of that, let me now turn back to the situation in Ukraine. And over the course of last night, we had yet another massive missile and drone strike by the Russians across Ukraine. And from what I can tell, again, this was mostly focused against the energy system and Odessa, and Kiev once more seemed to have been heavily targeted, though it does seem as if other places across Ukraine were targeted also. So a lot is taking place. The Russian offensive in the sky continues as far as I can see, without any sign of diminution. In fact, most probably, it continues to intensify. Bezuglaya, the dissident MP, has made statements about what is happening. She says that Kiev is now at real risk of shutting down. She says that this especially applies to Kiev residents. This warning, her warnings imply directed Kiev residents. Kiev is a strategic and symbolic target. It is possible that it will be shut down completely. Completely means darkness without sewage and water supply in the middle of winter. Obviously, I cannot patch all the holes in state management or neutralize the Russians, but I try to warn and tell it like it is. And Bezuglaya is basically also saying that the Ukrainians have lost completely their ability to counter Russian strikes, that the Russians can destroy any target in Ukraine that they choose. And, well, that's Bezuglaya. But another Ukrainian official, Colonel Yuri Ignat, who has been Ukraine's air defense spokesman, he's now basically saying that the Russian strikes across Ukraine are now so broad-based, the Russians are able to launch so many drones and so many missiles at one and the same time. The Russian missiles are now so sophisticated that it is impossible for Ukraine's air defense to keep up with what the Russians are doing. And again, to quote him, the strike today is more dispersed, not in one specific area, but we see the different regions are affected. The peculiarity of this strike is the use of a large number of ballistic missiles, he means Iskander missiles, in addition to two Arrow ballistic daggers, that's Kinjals, 14 ballistic missiles, Iskander M's, were used at once. These ballistic missiles attack different regions from different directions, with the main strike being on critical infrastructure facilities, energy and gas production facilities. And Ignat apparently claimed that one Kinjal. I think he was talking not about last night's strike, by the way, but about the strike on the previous day. That one Kinjal was shot down, and four Iskanders were shot down. But the reality is that, and that the Patriots were used to do that. I am profoundly sceptical about those claims, just saying. But then he also went on to say that the range of the Patriot missile system anyway is limited to approximately 25 kilometres. So it is impossible to achieve comprehensive coverage across the whole of Ukraine if an attack is being conducted in this way against targets spread out in the way that is happening now. And, well, personally, I don't believe that the Ukrainians are anywhere near as successful in shooting down missiles and drones, as Ignat says. I remember when the Russians first deployed Kinjal missiles, Ignat denied that the Patriots could shoot them down. He was then told, at risk of summary dismissal, and for a time he was even suspended from his job, that he must, from that moment forward, claim that the Patriots were indeed successful in shooting down the Kinjal missiles. We saw recently in an article in the Financial Times that there are good reasons to doubt that that is, in fact, the case. But the reality is that the Russians are able to conduct strikes now on such an overwhelming scale that they're able to do it night after night using hundreds of drones and scores of missiles. And there is really no answer from Ukraine against attacks on this scale. The air defense system, as far as I can see, has essentially broken down. And both Bezuklaya and Ignat are now essentially saying that it has proved to be ineffective. Well, we're getting lots and lots of lists about the targets that the Russians are destroying across Ukraine. Bezuklaya does perhaps sometimes have a tendency to catastrophize, but note what she is saying, that the Russians have the ability to shut down Kiev completely, to shut down Kiev, to deprive it of all of electricity, of water, and to destroy its sewage facilities. If anything like this does indeed happen, then I come back to what I said yesterday. In 2023, at the very start of the Russian offensive in the sky, when it was on a far smaller scale than what we are seeing now, the Ukrainians apparently considered evacuating the civilian population from Kiev, or at least that is what they said. Perhaps it's time, if they really meant that then, that they consider doing it now. Perhaps, given the scale of the Russian offensive in the sky, it is their duty to do it now. Anyway, these attacks are being conducted with weapons that the Russians have already used many times in this war. Iskander missiles, Kinjal missiles, other cruise missiles, Geran drones, they have been used by the Russians at many, well, basically since the outset of the war back in 2022. In a recent program, I asked who was the individual who basically conceived the Geran drone program, the massive scale of the Geran program, who had the idea of buying the Geran drones from Iran, the original Shahid drones from Iran, of setting up the giant factories that produce them. And I said that this person, this individual, has changed the face of war. I have now been provided with an answer to that. It was none other than Sergei Shoigu, the former Russian defense minister. And I've been provided by a very reliable source whom I'm heavily indebted to for information at many times over the course of this conflict with the details of this. There's been much criticism in the West of Shoigu. But we can see how on this issue specifically, Shoigu may be, precisely because he's an engineer, had a degree of insight and of imagination that, as far as I know, no one else had. The same source said that when Shoigu came up with the proposal, the general staff adopted it enthusiastically. Gerasimov backed it. The decision to create the factories was therefore a collective effort. The giant factory that we all know about in Kazan was built, but two other huge factories are being built also. And I think it was the same source who told me some months ago that one of them is apparently situated in North Korea, or at any rate uses North Korean workers. So production of Gerans continues to grow. And I believe that we could indeed be looking at 1,000 units a day by the end of the year. The Russians are on track to achieve that. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about the offensive in the sky. Putin, over the course of his trip to Dushanbe, said that the Russians are about to unveil various new types of weapon systems that they have not brought into serial production yet. So the Oreshnik system is indeed in serial production and is entering deployment on a significant scale. And Putin has discussed this at length. So it doesn't seem that this is the system that he was referring to. Some are saying that the new system that he is talking about is the new Burevestnik, nuclear-powered cruise missile, of which, by the way, photographs exist, and it looks like a rather bigger version of the KH-101 missile, which is launched from Russian strategic bombers, though it looks as if the Burevestnik will be a land-based system. Supposedly, there have been recent tests of this cruise missile, which would have no difficulty reaching the continental United States if it was launched from within Russia, by the way. It might be that this is what Putin was referring to. But there are systems that I've been hearing about also that the Russians are also apparently working upon. There is said to be a hypersonic missile, rather similar in some ways to the Oreshnik, but using a thermobaric warhead, which means, by the way, that it works on a kind of fuel-air explosive system. I've heard it suggested that this is physically impossible, that it would be impossible to have a warhead of that kind on a system that, flies at hypersonic speeds. I am completely ignorant of these things, and I'm not going to get into a discussion of this, but I suspect that engineering and all kinds of things might make this possible. As I said, I'm not going to discuss this. But anyway, if a system like that is... Well, I've heard a lot about this system, and I've been told that it was only just behind the Oreshnik in development and was likely to enter service over the course of this year. And it might be that it is indeed now entering service. And, well, we'll see what it's like. It's been described to me as a kind of super Iskander. Anyway, maybe I haven't understood exactly what it is, but maybe that is indeed what is coming. There is other reports which are perhaps even more interesting in some ways, which is that there have been some reports from coming from within Russia that the Russians have developed a system that would be capable of defeating once and for all the threat of FPV drones on the front lines, and that this is now about to enter service. There are lots of rumours as to how this alleged system might operate. Some say that it uses electronic warfare to jam these drones. That's possible. I mean, the Ukrainians mostly still use radio-controlled drones, but they've had difficulties transitioning to the fiber optic drones, which are the ones that the Russians now increasingly use. So it might be that this is an electronic warfare system. But there's also been suggestions that this is a laser-powered system, and that it is apparently all but foolproof, and it is about to enter serial production and service, and that it will defeat the Ukrainian FPV drones and end the threat of the Ukrainian FPV drones once and for all. Well, I don't know, but it does seem as if all sorts of rather interesting things are coming, and we'll just have to wait and see what they are. There is one other system that the Russians have talked about considerably over some time, and that is the Poseidon underwater submarine, nuclear-powered submarine drone, which carries a major warhead. But I understand that this has been in low-level service for some time, and I don't believe that that is what the weapon system that Putin is talking about. Anyway, let's talk about some other things, because Putin gave a press conference in Dushanbe, and I said in my program, over the course of my program yesterday, that Putin and those close to him, Yuri Ushakov and Dmitry Peskov and Putin himself, seem to be trying to push back against the hardliners who have been saying, as was said by the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov to the Duma, that the entire Anchorage process, the process that was achieved in Anchorage, the meeting between Putin and Trump in Anchorage, had been a failure, and that the entire process of negotiations had come in effect to a total stop. I've discussed now in various programs, and we've also discussed, Alex and I, on the Duran, how there does indeed appear to be a high-level debate going on about this precise topic within the highest levels of the Russian leadership. Well, Putin gave a press conference, and it seemed to me that this press conference, which took place following the meeting in Dushanbe between Putin and the leaders of the Commonwealth of Independent States, the rump organization that was established following the end of the Soviet Union by Boris Yeltsin. Anyway, it seemed to me that the press conference provided further evidence that there are indeed disagreements on this very topic within Russia. And here I'm just going to go over some of the things that took place over this press conference. Firstly, Putin was asked directly about whether it is indeed the case that the whole process of negotiations with the United States is indeed in deadlock, whether it had in fact basically stalled in the way that had been suggested. And the question came from Andrei Kolesnikov of Kommersant. Kommersant is a very, very important newspaper in Russia. It's basically a leading business newspaper, but it's a newspaper that many people in Russia read. And he was asked this question: prior to your visit to Dushanbe, one of the deputy foreign ministers of Russia, Ryabkov, just to say, said that the potential of Anchorage has been exhausted. Do you agree with this assertion? Is that the end of the matter? And you could see that Putin was not pleased to be asked that question, because he then said, what exactly would you like to hear? That was his response. And then Kolesnikov came back and said, I would like to hear that it has not, in fact, been exhausted. And then Putin came back and said, do you understand the issue? We did not fully disclose what was discussed in Anchorage. We simply stated that in general, there is an understanding, both on the part of the United States and the Russian Federation, of where we would move and what we should strive for in order to end this conflict, and by peaceful means at that. These are not simple matters. We agreed with Donald that I, too, would need to consider the matter in Moscow and discuss it with our colleagues, as well as consult our allies. He told me the same. These are complex issues requiring further elaboration, but we remain grounded in the discussions that took place in Anchorage. We are not changing our position on this and believe that some additional work is needed on both sides. However, overall, we remain within the framework of the Alaska agreements. Now, to me, I have to say this looks like a fudge. It looks like Putin wanting to say, well, Anchorage is not exhausted. You don't really know what we, Trump and I, Donald, as he refers to him, Trump and I, discussed in Anchorage. I'm not at liberty to tell you. We're still working according to that framework. It's not exhausted. But then notice that he doesn't at any point actually say that any actual progress is being made. It comes across to me, frankly, as Putin, very uncharacteristically for him, evading a proper answer. He clearly isn't happy to be asked the question. He doesn't want to say that progress is exhausted, but he can't actually give any concrete reason to think otherwise. And then, well, we had further comments, a very strange exchange with his favoured journalist, Pavel Zarubin. Now, over the course of I think it was a program that we did on the Duran, Alex and I, and I think also to some extent on this channel. I discussed the meeting that Putin had with the generals, the one where he met with Gerasimov and with the group of forces commanders. And I noticed that the meeting took place in St. Petersburg, and I couldn't see why this meeting took place in St. Petersburg as opposed to, say, Moscow. There has been no explanation of this. There's been no scheduled trip by Putin to St. Petersburg that I was aware of. And it looked as if this meeting took place for some completely unexplained reason in St. Petersburg. And I pointed out that St. Petersburg is not just Russia's second capital, but a major center of Russia's military. And I did wonder whether Putin visited St. Petersburg because of the recent concerns about the deteriorating situation between Russia and the Western powers in the Arctic. St. Petersburg is a major Russian naval base. It is a center of Russia's naval shipbuilding industry. It is, of course, a major economic center, but the Russian Navy has a major presence there. And I wondered whether something else was going on. Well, somebody else, one other person, also was puzzled about why the meeting with the generals took place in St. Petersburg. And that was none other than Pavel Zarubin, who is Putin's favorite journalist and is normally very well informed about Putin's movements and about Putin's thinking. And Zarubin asked Putin this question. On that day, that's to say the day when Putin met with the generals, we were again wondering where you were and what you were doing, because no, normally nobody ever sees how you celebrate your birthday in the evening. You saw that you were with the military at the Peter and Paul Cathedral in St. Petersburg, in the sepulchre with tombs of Russian emperors, beginning with Peter the Great. Why there? And why with the military at that? Well, this sort of implies that Putin, who is a native of St. Petersburg, decided this time to celebrate his birthday in St. Petersburg, which is perhaps understandable, that he called the military to there for that reason, and that they all trooped off to the Peter and Paul Cathedral, which they did, and went to Peter the Great's tomb. And Putin then gave a long explanation about how Peter was the great founder of the Russian state, and that it was under Peter the Great and Catherine the Great that Russia made its greatest territorial acquisitions, and that it was therefore fully appropriate that he and the Russian generals should visit the tombs of Peter the Great and, by the way, by extension, of Catherine the Great. Well, because of all of that. Now, what Putin didn't say is that, of course, it was under Peter and Catherine that the Russians consolidated and then expanded their control of the territory of what is now Ukraine. It was Peter who defeated the Cossack hetman or leader, Mazepa, and who defeated the Swedes at the Battle of Poltava, which is precisely in the territory of Ukraine, and not that far from where the current battles are taking place. And it was, of course, Catherine the Great, who then was the empress under whom the Russians conquered the rest of, well, the southern shores of the Black Sea, so Crimea, the territory upon which Odessa and Nikolaev and all of these places were built. And again, visiting the tombs of these two previous rulers might be a way to remind the generals on the occasion of Putin's birthday that this is what the Russian army achieved during the reign of that emperor and that empress, Peter the Great and Catherine, and that the time had come for the army to emulate their achievements. Anyway, that suggests a more hardline Putin, even as Putin, as I said, fudges the question, is evasive about the question of what happened, of what happened between himself and Trump at Anchorage, appears to cling on to the idea that some kind of rapprochement, détente with the United States is still possible, despite everything, even though he has absolutely nothing concrete to show. So anyway, this was in some ways a very revealing answer, in some ways the most revealing answer of all. And to me, by the way, it reinforces my view that the military, over the course of those discussions in St. Petersburg, were basically given the green light to continue their advance, and if they can, which I'm sure they can, by the way, to push on towards Odessa. The way that Putin describes it is that they first went to the Peter and Paul fortress, they visited the tombs of Peter the Great and Catherine, and then they came back and they had that meeting at presumably the Konstantinovsky Palace, which is Putin's residence, the president's residence in St. Petersburg, and there they perfected their battle plans. So you can draw your own conclusions. And anyway, then we had perhaps the weirdest exchange of all, because Putin, after having that rather interesting exchange with Zarubin, suddenly noticed that somebody else was seeking to interject a question. And he then says, out of nowhere, bear in mind I'm not there, but he said, pardon? What? About which tomahawks? That comes out of nowhere. So presumably one of the reporters, one of the journalists at this press conference was shouting a question at shouting a question. He said, you haven't talked about the tomahawks yet. That's basically what it said. And Putin says, pardon? What? About which tomahawks? And then the journalist in question, who is somebody called Stanislav Ivaschenko, says, the American ones. And then Putin says, go ahead. And Ivaschenko, who is a journalist for Zvezda TV, Zvezda, I should say, is a military channel, just to say. It's connected to the Russian military. Zvezda means star. And, well, one of the symbols of the Russian military is the Red Star. Anyway, Ivaschenko said this. In Kiev, Zelensky threatens to strike Russia with tomahawks, even targeting the Kremlin itself. There is even talk that this constitutes a form of posturing, blackmail against Russia. And then Putin responded, you did not misspeak, posturing as well. There is certainly an element of showing off here. So that's what he thinks of Zelensky, that he's just posturing. He's just making all kinds of threats perhaps, which we shouldn't take altogether seriously. And then Ivaschenko comes back and he says, in this context, a question. The Americans say that whether they will transfer the Tomahawks or not depends entirely on Russia's negotiating position. Regarding Ukraine, if our negotiating position does not suit them, they will proceed with the transfer. Is our response to this ready? And Putin, who's clearly not happy to be asked this question, it's been, as I said, thrown at him by a journalist who's shouting questions at him. Unusual for this to happen at press conferences with Putin, but we could see that he's challenged. Anyway, he cuts it short. He says, our response is the strengthening of the Russian Federation's air defense systems. And he doesn't say anything more. Well, we could see what is taking place. Putin being pushed to explain what is happening with Donald Trump. You had that meeting with him in Anchorage. Where is this all going? Is it really exhausted? Putin doesn't yet want to burn his bridges or slam the door on Donald Trump. He says, no, it's not exhausted. We talked about many things. We discussed many things. We had all sorts of ideas. But nothing, actually, he's actually nothing so far to show. I mean, you could see almost how embarrassed, at least to me, he comes across. His answer comes across as if he's both defensive and embarrassed on this question. Elsewhere, by the way, the Russians have confirmed that the Ukrainians are no longer even responding to inquiries from the Russians about restarting the discussions in Istanbul. The Russians have been sending the messages about, you know, the next Istanbul meeting, the setting up of the three working parties, and the Ukrainians are stonewalling. So Putin, annoyed and embarrassed about this, he's clearly unhappy about being asked questions about the Tomahawks as well. He doesn't want to say anything that Donald Trump might see as threatening. He says, let's not take this seriously. The Ukrainians are just posturing. It's all really a bluff. The Tomahawks can't really be supplied to Ukraine. If they are supplied, well, our air defense systems are ready for them and we will deal with them. Many, many people in Russia are not going to be satisfied with this reply, by the way. And the fact that Putin cut it short shows that he doesn't want to discuss this whole topic at length. But by cutting it short, he is inviting further challenges. And I suspect when Medvedev, who heads the more hardline faction in the Security Council, returns from a trip which he's making currently to North Korea, where he's having meetings with Kim Jong-un and discussing further political and economic and military cooperation with the North Koreans, I suspect that this whole topic of how to respond to the Tomahawks and how to take forward the whole issue of the discussions with Donald Trump is going to resume again. But Putin also is showing that as far as Ukraine is concerned, he is now clearly signalling that the Russians are not going to stop at the four regions. He's hinted at this in other comments, but he took the generals to the Peter and Paul Fortress. He showed them the tombs of the emperors, Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, who who won the greatest victories in this precise territory. The Battle of Poltava, in Peter's case, the conquest of Crimea and Novorossiya, in Catherine's case, the building of the great cities of Sevastopol and Odessa. Sevastopol, its name in Greek, means the city of the empress, who is, of course, none other than Catherine herself. So we see Putin at one and the same time taking a very hard line with the Ukrainians, harder perhaps than he has ever taken up to this time, giving them the green light, at the same time as he still clings on to this idea that something can be patched up with Donald Trump. It's an extraordinary, incredibly difficult balancing act, and I wonder how much longer Putin is going to be able to sustain it. We see that the Chinese have increasingly shown signs, well, have now shown signs, that they are losing patience with Trump. And we can see that Putin is under pressure from people within the Russian leadership who are showing signs that they're losing patience also. Anyway, in the meantime, the war goes on. Lots continues to happen on the battlefronts. There is now visual confirmation that the Russians have successfully recaptured the village of Vladimirovka in the area of their breakthrough of August, northeast of Pokrovsk. And there is now extensive footage which appears to confirm that there is intense fighting going on a little to the west for control of the Pokrovska mine. The Russians are bombing Ukrainian positions on the mine heavily with Fab bombs. I expect that the Russians will recapture the mine, fairly soon. There is a very weird article in The Guardian by a journalist who's clearly been briefed, a Guardian journalist who's clearly been briefed by the Ukrainians. He is located in the town of Druzhivka, which is some distance away from this area of the breakthrough. He's not actually been on the battlefronts, but the Ukrainians have given this journalist a glaring account of their successful counteroffensive in this area of the Russian breakthrough. And the article confirms my suspicions that it is this counteroffensive, this largely fictitious Ukrainian counteroffensive, that was the basis of all of the Ukrainian claims to Kellogg, to put Trump himself, to other Western officials, that on the contrary, far from Ukraine losing the war, it is the Ukrainians who have put the Russians on the back foot. The reality, and now the evidence is so clear that it cannot be denied any longer, is the diametric opposite. The Ukrainian counterattacks in the area of the Russian breakthrough have been not only unsuccessful, but in my opinion, probably disastrous. They have bled the Ukraine's best reserves dry. Not only have the Russians recaptured whatever villages the Ukrainians were able to capture in these counterattacks, like Vladimirovka, for example, but it looks as if they're about to capture the key village of Shakhovo in this area and the Pokrovska mine as well. And it looks as if the Battle of Kupiansk is in some ways even more complicated and much bigger than I realised, because it is becoming clear over the last couple of days, especially the last couple of hours, that the Russian objective in this battle is not just to recapture the town of Kupiansk itself, which it seems that they have largely achieved. But to trap several Ukrainian brigades on the east, who are still on the east bank of the Oskol River, precisely in the Kupiansk area, it's still difficult to get an exact picture of what is going on there. But it's starting to look as if a large body, a large group of Ukrainian soldiers might have been encircled, effectively trapped by the Russians in the Kupiansk area on the east bank of the Oskol River without any obvious route to escape what is now an effective encirclement. And I've read reports that this force might number up to 10,000 men, in which case we are looking at a potential military disaster for the Ukrainians. But of course, I have no independent evidence of this. The fact that things for the Ukrainians are going very, very badly on the battlefronts, not just in the sky, is further provided perhaps by the latest comments by Zelensky. As I briefly said yesterday, he is now talking about, he has now given further authorization to the Ukrainian intelligence to conduct further operations, assassinations and sabotage and all of that against the Russians on the territory of Russia itself. That's how I interpret his statement. And he's now pleading for a ceasefire during the forthcoming Olympic Games. Olympic Games, from which, by the way, the Russians themselves are excluded. There's been no indication that the Russians are interested in agreeing to all of this. Anyway, there it is. This is where I'm going to finish today's programme. We see that on with respect to Ukraine, Putin now appears to be taking the hardest line that he has shown in this war up to now. He's signalling to the military that they now have the green light to advance, continue to advance further west and to fulfill their plan to recapture the whole of Ukraine's Black Sea coast, even as he tries to maintain some kind of relationship with Trump. Everywhere, his Chinese friends and allies, however, are now taking steps to renew their conflict with Trump on economic and trade issues. So, an extraordinarily complex and very tense situation. We have two epic struggles underway. A struggle between China and the United States, fought out in the fields of economics and trade and technology, and an actual war being fought by the Russians, a proxy war being fought by the Russians against the West in Ukraine. And of course, in relation to that war, I don't think there's any real doubt, can be any real doubt any longer, that it's not just a case of the Russians winning it, but that a crisis in that war is now coming. So this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Don't forget, you can you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. And last but not least, don't forget, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel.